listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this episode. We have a very special guest, singer-songwriter, extraordinary guitarist, Mr. Darnell Cole. How are you?
Doing well. Just letting all my followers know that they got to tune in, man. You know, I love it. Earlier, so, you know, I'm hoping they letting them know I'm live.
You know what's funny? In this day and age of being an artist, you got to juggle 10 different things in the air, and you can't just be an artist. It kind of drives me crazy.
Tell it's me how definitely you... the worst part of doing this music thing, right? Because, yes. Like, obviously the music and the performances is probably the most exciting part, I would say, for most artists, you know? But something about the marketing and the business side, it feels icky. It feels icky. It's necessary, but it feels icky.
Well, and it's also, I'm sure, I don't know if you've gone through this. It's like, I've hired people to do this stuff, and nobody does it well. It's so crazy.
Everybody's just winging it. Everybody's shooting from the hip.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it beautiful. I think, you know, there's a lot of controversy about, you know, music today versus music before. And everyone says, oh, it's easier now. It's harder now, depending on, you know, how you want to look at it. I think it's probably just as hard as it's ever been, but just all the secrets are out now.
Yes.
You know, there's only a couple more that are kept. And I think one of them is that nobody knows what they're doing. I think nobody knew what they were doing back in the day. That's how you end up with a band like, oh my gosh, I just have Grateful Dead. And I love Grateful Dead. Don't get me wrong. But 18-hour jam band doesn't happen from algorithm. That doesn't happen from people knowing what they're doing. That happens from dudes taking their guitars and drums and keys and everything and being like, let's just play these for 18 hours.
Well, and it's also like the good thing about what they did is they built their own empire, which now every artist has to do. And it's like, when I look at artists now, it's like when somebody asks me the same question, like, do you think it's easier? I say, actually, I think in some ways it's easier and better. In some ways it's way harder because back in the day, you'd have labels signing artists and you'd only have a finite amount of artists that were able to go into the studios. And now because of home studios, you're now competing with the orthodontist that wants to put out a CD and decides, hey, I played guitar a long time ago. I'm going to put a CD out. And now that's in the stratosphere and there's no kind of like delineation between, oh, these are real artists and this is a hobbyist.
Well, that's what kind of makes it frustrating. Yes. I think that's what makes it frustrating because I've realized, and I said this years ago, you know, pay to play used to be, I think, a beautiful thing because people would go and sell their tickets and they would promote their bands and they were serious about their music. So people were probably more apt to buy tickets from somebody they didn't know because they were like, you know what, they're putting in the work. I'm going to see this band.
Right.
And then it blossomed. Then you get these bands that aren't in it to be good. They're in it to be successful. It's a thing I've been saying for a while. And, you know, they were just selling or buying tickets and giving them out, you know, and getting friends to go, which is good. Like, your friends should support you. Right. But then when bands who aren't well rehearsed, I don't like saying bad because a lot of people are like, oh, that band sounds so horrible. maybe it's just not your thing. You know, maybe out of time synth polka jazz metal we're just not hip to it yet. You know?
Right. Right.
But there's definitely a difference between it being intentional and rehearsed and not rehearsed. So you get these bands that are just not well rehearsed going and doing these performances and Joe Schmo Public is like, what is this? And they're getting turned off to it. And it happens so much at so many iconic places. Looking at you, Whiskey. Looking at you, Viper Room. You know, that now people are like, oh, you're in a band. Ooh, it's a live band. Ooh, they're an original band. Mm. And they have this sour taste because it's almost it's almost like when people were like, yeah, I'm a SoundCloud rapper. You know, and again, no disrespect. Like, there's a lot of SoundCloud rappers that got bars for days. That's fine. But when you're 48 and SoundCloud rapping is your pinnacle, I don't think that that's necessarily my idea of success.
Right.
And I think that, you know, there's a lot of ego that goes into these mediums when people are doing that, you know, and I think that needs to get separated because it bleeds over to real artists who are trying to make a difference.
Right. I will agree with you about 99% of everything you said, except for the pay to play thing. I'll tell you why. Like I've never done the pay to play thing and I never will, because to me, I think it's super bogus because you do all the work. You sell all the tickets, the promoter does nothing, and then they make a big cut and you're left with a little cut. And it's like, no, you know, so I actually, what's funny is last May around this time, we headlined the Whiskey. And when I first called the Whiskey, they gave me the same thing. They're like, okay, we're going to sell you these tickets. You got to sell them. And I'm like, nah, man, we don't do that. I'm like, we've headlined the House of Blues 25 times. We brought 1,000 people there. Like, we're not going to do that. So I was like, you know, let me talk to the main booker. And so I talked to the main booker and he's like, well, we've never worked together. I'm like, yeah, but you got to start somewhere. And we ended up, you know, headlining a show there. And what was so crazy was because I had not worked with them, our fans don't even do the pre-sale tickets. Like, I could post a pre-sale ticket, maybe 15 people will buy it. And I don't expect that those are going to be our numbers on the show night, you know?
Right.
But so like literally a week, maybe like 10 days before the show, he's like, we may have to cancel this, man. There's only 5 tickets sold. I said, do not. People are flying in for this. Just trust me. People are going to come. And when we showed up, you know, like on the day of, we ended up selling like something like 220 tickets, something like that. And what was crazy is he was like, you know, it started to trickle in. But he said, I got to tell you, I was worried. I said, I wasn't worried. But the problem is, if I had gone through a promoter, I wouldn't have been able to pay all the openers. I wouldn't have been able to pay all my musicians. And it's like, that's where promoters, if you're a promoter, and I don't care what it is, if you're a festival promoter or a club promoter or a radio promoter, your job is literally to promote. Like, your sole job is to bring people to said venue, said artist, said radio airplay, whatever it is. And the job of the promoter right now, unless they're a huge festival promoter, they don't do that part of the job.
No, that's because their job title changed now. See, now they just contact bands, tell them to show up at a time with vague information.
Right.
With miscommunicated information on top of that. And then they take the majority cut and tell you, oh, man, I had to do this and do that. So here's a dollar.
Right.
That's, you know. No, I think we're actually in agreement because I'm not a fan of pay to play.
I think it's so jive. It's super jive.
What it is how it used to be.
Right.
And what it has transformed into is two different things.
Yes.
You know, I remember even when we started doing this thing full time, you know, and really like pushing the music to be a thing, you know, there was merit to, you know what, it's pay to play, but you are opening direct support for insert person.
Yes.
And as long as you sold X amount, you were still going to make money, and that's fine. What it turned into is, well, they brought their direct support, so you're really going to be 3 or 4 bands in front, maybe.
Yes.
And then
just so dry, that, super dry.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it doesn't make any sense.
You know, like, have you heard of buy-ins?
I love this.
Kind of talking the real talk. Like what people don't realize is like when they go to a show and they see an artist, that label has done a buy-in to make sure that artist is there. Or the other side of it is, okay, this promoter wants, you know, Kings of Leon to headline this festival, but the booking agent will be like, we'll only play this festival if you take these 3 junior bands that we just signed. Yep. That'll be great. So it's like these bands go into these festivals. I actually was just talking to a promoter about this. They go into these festivals with little to no experience and do not have the goods to be there. And when you see them play, it's like, what is this? So now that 2 p.m., 3 p.m., 4 p.m. slot for a festival, which should have a slamming band that nobody's ever heard of, that makes everybody excited for the headliner. You get a really kind of so-so performance, and then it ruins it for indie bands.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Time that, you know what I mean? That are
not only that, what you end up getting more often than not because of the label connections is you get a watered down version of the headliner.
Right.
You know, because they keep to a certain type of thing. And, you know, I've done a couple festivals. I'm doing some coming up on this UK tour we got coming up.
It's amazing, by the way. We'll talk about that in a second.
Thank you. And, you know, I've done the thing where it's like all the bands are very similar, all the bands are very different, and everything kind of in between. And I think that there's pros to cons to it. I understand the idea, right? We like blues rock. We have a blues rock community. We should do a blues rock festival, right? Like as a promoter. And like that's, I can see that vision. The issue becomes you have to have the nuances that span the spectrum of that genre. Right. So it's like, this is blues rock. This is blues rock. So we need everything here. Oftentimes what they do is they go, well, this is the blues rock that's selling and charting right now. So we're just going to get a whole bunch of this and then a little bit of everything else. And it's like, you know, I don't know.
Well, also like charting. That's another thing. Like when I think of charting, and I know you know this, you probably do. And it most people don't. It's like when people talk about, oh, over a billion streams, I'm like paid for and fake. When I think about charting, I'm like, paid for and fake. I'm like, that's not a merit. It's like, show me a band that like I can see and they can play. It's like, or the singer's not auto-tuned to death. And when I see them live, I'm like, yo, this is nothing compared to what your record sounds like. What people don't realize is the good bands, and I would say the good and the great bands, they sound better live than they do on CD or vinyl.
At least they should. At least they should.
And the bands that don't, what people don't, and this is what I tell my friends all the time, like when you hear a perfect example, the Black Keys, they're a huge band. I've seen them two or three times. They're much better on CD than they are live. They really? Don't. Yeah, it's crazy. They don't play. They don't have like the greatest pocket. And it's like when I hear them play, I'm like, yo, there's only two of you and you have some guy playing backstage or even have additional people on stage. There aren't that many people on stage. You should be tight as shit. And instead, I think it's like kind of lackluster, but they've had so much promotion that people are just like, they eat it up. And I'm like, this doesn't sound as good as, you know, I've seen, you know, somebody like a Gary Clark Jr. with a trio that to me is way better and way tighter and not as big and they've had half the promotion, you know what I mean? So to me, it's like the good bands, they you're not going to get there. You're not, the listeners aren't going to be wooed on the CD or the album. They'll like them, but when you see them live, they should be better. And the records, the artists that are less than, you know, good, I feel like their records sound so great and they ride on that.
It's two different art forms, right? It's two different art forms. I think that, And that's something that me as an artist has had to learn because for the longest, I had focused so much on live that the recorded was lacking. And I think that what in looking at it at two different mediums, what I've come to the conclusion is it doesn't necessarily have to be done live as it is on the record. I've evolved in my thinking on that. However, it does have to hit you the same. It does have to have the same feeling that it does. And that's the key, you know, and something simple that I talk about. So in the album that's out right now, Man of Soul, there's a couple things where like, there's like a tambourine, you know, or like a second guitar here and there. And, you know, live, especially now that we've kind of morphed into this trio versus a quad, you know, it doesn't happen. It's not there, but there are hits that, you know, my drummer Jeet would do on the drums. There's different chord voicings that I'll do on the guitar that lend themselves to do that feeling. Plus now we're moving or we'll get the crowd clapping and that's taking the place of like the tambourine or something. You know what I'm saying? So it's there's not a loss. There's a change. There's a shift. Right. You know, instead of chicken, I'm doing steak, but you're still getting protein.
Yes. I love that you said that. And also, you know, like I've had a 6-piece band for 20 plus years and I recently got into a trio and this is the biggest difference. And maybe you notice this with your own thing, it's like when I play in a 6-piece band, I'm playing rhythm guitar riffs and I know there's going to be all this other stuff going on. With the trio, I noticed, like, I can write something complicated, but when I'm singing it live, I may have to simplify it just so it's, like, not the same thing because I'm only relying on myself. So it's, like, I notice that I may come up with a part on a record that I'm, like, oh, this is going to be so great for the record. And then when I play it live, I'm, like, I'm going to modify this so I can also have it sound different and do its own thing. Do you find that with your trio that
there's some parts
you simplify because you want it to kind of still
so like, yes, different? Short answer is yes. I think for me what it is it comes down to how integral it is. If I think it's integral, if it's the motif, if it's the riff, then I have to find a way to do it live.
Right.
Because it's the thing that people are latching on to. Now, if it's just an add-on, if it's a spice, then yeah. So perfect example, we got this song Gypsy Soul. And the keys come in on it and they play this melody or whatever. And once we stopped kind of having a keys player, I started doing that on the intro on the guitar. And okay. So it comes in first for the intro. So you hear it. So you're like, oh, there's the thing I know from the record. And then once I'm singing, it doesn't show up anymore. So you only get it that one time. But that's okay because on the record, that's the time when you hear it. Every other time, it's a little reminder of like, hey, don't forget this thing. So, and I like to think that does okay with it. Similarly,
a live arrangement. You know what I mean? It's like, all of my favorite musicians, they all do that too. It's like there's a certain thing that the album sounds like, and then there's a certain thing they do to make the live version sound like. There are times too when I write, I find like I may write a riff, maybe it's the main riff, but like when it's just the trio, maybe it's gonna sound too busy with everything going on when it's live. You know what I mean? It's like, so I'm like listening to the groove of the bass and drums, you know, and I'm like, yo, this worked on the record, but it doesn't totally like work like
the
this.
The other thing too, like, is you can swap instruments.
Yes.
So you can have the bass do the guitar riff. I've done that before. One time we covered a Black Sabbath song and, you know, Iommi's got those riffs. He's a riff king. And so I was trying to do that and sing and it wasn't happening.
Yeah,
but you get the bassist to do it. And now I can just kind of chug a little bit and you're still getting the same vibe. It's a different arrangement, but now at least you're still hearing the melodies you want to hear just in a different timbre.
You're making a new recipe of the same recipe.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about this UK tour. So you're going to be on tour, playing a couple festivals and kind of touring around the UK. Tell us the dates. Tell us a little bit of the festivals. Tell us some of the things that are going on.
Yeah. So June 17th is when we head out, and we'll be there. Our first show is on the 21st. We're going to be at the Bourne Music Club. It's a little spot in Kent. It's awesome. They're just such amazing individuals. They're a lot of the places on the tour, to be fair. England's just a different world, man. Like their appreciation for music is huge. At least for me and my music. So I've got a lot of love for them, for the Little Island. But our second gig is the Isle of Wight Festival.
So awesome.
Isle of Wight, We're going to be on the Cashmere Cafe stage. And I'm stoked. I'm stoked to do it. You know, I mean, Green Day's headlining.
It's been around since the 60s, I think.
Oh, yeah. It was Jimi Hendrix's last festival.
That's so crazy.
So this is a big thing. It's meant a lot to you know, be able to go there and share our music with them. So very honored to be on that one. And thankful for the support that's gotten me there. You know, every year we go back, you know, I try to do it better. I try to do, you know, just to make sure. Because for me, you know, if I'm not seeing progress, I'm doing something wrong. Right. And you know, every year it's just been something. So this one was a big one for me. So is that got to see.
And I remember you were telling me that you were getting – a better response or a bigger response in the UK. Tell me a little bit about that, because I think that's something I want our listeners to kind of be like, wait a minute, that shouldn't be happening. We should be paying attention here. You know,
man, they better get hit. They better tap in. Look, man, the difference is small, but it makes all the difference. Okay. When we're here in the US and we play a venue and maybe they don't know us, they'll go, I don't know this band, and they'll size us up, and you know, what they look like, what's that guitar, what kind of amp, and they go, I'm out, right? Because people see with their eyes here, they're very trendy, and they want to know that it's somebody already. That's right. In the U.S., that's generally how it is. Now, the UK is similar. I'm not saying that they're not trendy. There's not an air of doubt when a band walks in that's unknown. But the small difference is they'll give you one drink. They'll say, okay, I'm going to buy a pint and I'm going to listen to you. I'm going to give you one song. And you have until they finish that drink to impress them and keep them there. And I promise you, that's all you need, because that's at least two or three songs. So your first three songs got to hit. They got to do the thing. And, you know, I've been blessed that every time I gone out there, you know, the reception has been phenomenal. Last year, we played some places I'd never been to. Ticketed venues. Couple hundred people. Couple hundred in places I've never played, to faces I've never seen. You know, I mean, a couple, you know, fans that I've seen before, a couple familiar faces, but like people I don't know. And it's and the promoters, they promote. They actually promote.
Rare. That's a very rare thing.
You know, not out there. It's much more common that they actually do their job out there. And they have a following. They'll do Facebook groups and the groups will kind of follow them. And it just becomes this whole culture where, you know, it can get clicky at times. And, you know, you definitely want to make sure that you do everything right on your end as best you can. But honestly, it's such a breath of fresh air.
Right. Well, it's also like, you know, you realize why Jimi Hendrix and Bob Marley both went to England to break. It's like,
oh yeah,
you know, Bob was getting big in Jamaica, and then, you know, after he got shot at, basically he was like, I need to leave. But I think because he was in England, the seeds that were developing over there, much like Hendrix, made him even bigger and larger than life. And same with Hendrix, you know.
And honestly, the other thing too that nobody likes to talk about, but it's 2024, and Cat Williams said we're exposing truth this year, man.
Yeah.
Honestly, man, they don't care what you look like over there, man. They don't care where you're from. They don't care nothing of that. They care about the music. And unfortunately, in America, it's still a thing. Now, I'm not saying that every gig I don't get is because I'm a black dude. That's not what I'm saying.
I have this conversation all the time with lots of people.
But yes. I tell people, if I send an email out as Darnell versus I send it out as Jonathan Smith, I get replies.
That's crazy. You know what? It's like, it's really backwards too, because you have, you know, you think that like, oh, Elvis Presley, oh, Led Zeppelin, oh, like, you know, these are artists I love. Like, they got breaks, and it's still happening like that. Like, if I look at a lot of songwriters, and this was when I was coming up, I'm a little bit older than you, I think, but when I was coming up, man, there were no songwriters that looked like me. And it's like, for me, I have to fight hard to get into these festivals. And we played a lot of festivals. We're playing the world's largest festival, Summerfest, in June, and we're opening for the Nappy Roots. And what I love about this festival is, like, they actually pair us. Like, I've opened for Gary Clark Jr. there. I've opened up for...
Whoa, let's go.
I opened up for ZZ Top there. And it's like, they put you on huge stages opening for big people. And it doesn't matter the genre of music. It's like, yo, this is the way it should be. But every other festival that we play, it is like, we've had to wait years to play that said festival. And it's very compartmentalized, and it's very agent friendly to who's headliner, all that stuff. So it's refreshing to hear you say this about the UK, because I have so much love for London and all of England, you know?
Oh yeah. Well, and that's the thing. And like, what's ironic is like, I do better in the north of England. So like your Leeds, your York, even like going into like Scotland. Yeah. Because the north of England is very much like the south of the U.S. And the south of the U.S., my music does better.
Wow. You know?
And I think if I'm to dissect it as much as I can, I think that conservative areas, more conservative leaning areas, depending on how, you know, you want to fall on the spectrum, tend to like music that speaks to the working man, tends to like soul food music. Like, it likes... not even just traditional. I mean, it is, because that's in line, but there's a theme of trying to be real, authentic, and soulful. That I think it's not that liberal or more liberal leaning audiences don't resonate with, because that's not the case, but it's that there's much more trend and new, and how can we change and add bad, the more left you go. And that's why when you look at like LA, when you look at New York, when you look at London, when you look at these more left-leaning areas, you have a lot of hip-hop music is there because it's right on the precipice of what's new. You have right a lot of all the new indie pop, all the new metal, all the your Billie Eilishes of the world, you know what I'm saying? You know, all that stuff. And I think that it's a beautiful thing that and musicians get it. It's the non-musicians that don't get it. And I think that that's what's hilarious. And it's that for me, I look at it and I go, there's people on these widest ends of the spectrum that are coming together for music. And they don't even realize how together that they're brought by that, you know? And it's only in the small genre askewities, you know, that it starts to shift. And I don't know, it's weird how that kind of stuff happens. But that's the thing that I have noticed.
I think there's also, like, people over there, they don't buy into the media frenzy that people over here do.
Oh, facts.
It's like, if in England, if somebody's, if you went up to anybody in England, they're like, oh, they've got a billion streams. People would be like, okay, are they good? Whereas here, it's like, they got over a billion streams. Oh, they're great. It's like,
yes.
No, it's like, show us what you can do. That's what it should come down to. And
well, and it's one of those double-edged swords, right? Because as an artist, you want to have a lot of views. And right. I think that numbers are just that. They are just numbers. Right. They don't ever tell you the whole story, but they tell you a story. And that story is either going to be that they have paid for a lot of numbers or that they are good enough to get them. And so for me, if I see someone with a lot of numbers, the first question goes is, have I heard of them? Because if you got that many numbers and I haven't heard of you, chances are you bought them.
Yes.
Chances are. Or you have just the most silent yet like dedicated fan base that the world has heard of, which
or
is
you're on, or you're on a label and you have 45 interns making sure they're adding you and spread. I mean, it's like it's not the same game. Like, you are making a record for a finite amount of budget, and a Taylor Swift has an unlimited budget, or even a Gary Clark Jr. has a certain budget that is probably 5 to 10 to 20 times what any indie artist is spending on a record.
Easy.
And then they have a promotion wing. So it's like, it's just not, you can't compare those numbers to me, because it's like, you can't take an artist and say that one is better than the other. This is something I constantly ask myself. I'm sure, or wonder if you also ask this. I'm like, do I love the music I love because it was good or because it was marketed? And I ask this question to myself all the time, because I'm like, I love Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix is my dude. Like, I love Jimi Hendrix. But I'm like, he was also marketed at some point. And like, there are so many Jimi Hendrix type of artists that have never surfaced. And I'm like, I want to find those artists, because it's like, to me, I'm like, I want to find the artists that move me, no matter if it's marketed or not, because I think it's easy to be skewed when something is like, you know, kind of a, it's got the bells and whistles and it's got the nice pretty bow and it's put right in front of you. Whereas you, most people don't want to search for music. They want it kind of like hand delivered and, you know, like hand delivered to them on a big silver platter. So it's easy. You know what I mean? So it's like,
I think it's a healthy balance, because I mean, I think at some level it has to resonate with you.
Right.
But also, like, how do people listen to their music? Right. Because like they say, studies show that like most of the music you love, you formulate in your teens, that those 30 for like the 5 years that you're really out there listening to music, that whatever you find in that time, that's the music you like.
Right.
And unless you actively go and seek out new music. And Rick Beato, I actually got to meet him at NAMM. And so I was talking with him. And then he says this online, and he says, you know, I go out and I search out music. I like to go and try to find music, and it keeps things fresh. It keeps.
But he's a musician. He's a musician. Like,
sure, sure.
I think all musicians are always searching for music that inspires them. But they did this amazing experiment. I think about this all the time. They had a violinist named Joshua
in the Bell. Subway.
Yes, in the subway, and this guy sold out the Carnegie Hall. I think he did two nights at Carnegie Hall. Maybe not one. But whatever he did, yeah, he did two nights. And then they dressed him like a regular Joe and had him play in the subway in New York. And people were walking by like he was just, you know,
some dude.
Some random dude playing violin. And the only person that stopped was a little kid. It was like a little four-year-old girl that stopped and was like, oh my God, this is awesome. But I'm like, this is the difference of hype. It's like, this guy just played Carnegie Hall. He should be turning every head in that subway because he just sold out Carnegie Hall. So there lies, like, is it good because it's marketed or is it good? And he's a great musician. He's a great musician.
Yeah.
There's nothing against that. But then he must have had to see that as, oh, shit. Like, if I can't move everybody in this subway, maybe there is some part of my success that's due to marketing. I mean, that's I'm glad I wasn't the subject of that because I would be devastated.
So no, I don't think you should be devastated because there's another element that we're not addressing, which is context and where the listener's mind is. And this is the thing I try to explain at my shows because a lot of people, especially artists, especially the crowd and the artists both equally probably think this. Right, there's us, the fans, and there's them, the artists, and there's this separation, and we're having these two separate experiences. Right. We are enjoying a show, they are performing a show. Now, though that at some level that is true, the truth of the matter is that you're both at the show experiencing the show. One person is performing, the other is listening, but you're both watching each other and listening to each other and communicating to each other.
There's a dialogue.
Yes. And the thing of it is the difference between the people in that subway station and the people at Carnegie Hall. The people at Carnegie Hall went there with the intention to hear music. Yes. And they went there with, we're going to be wowed. And so wowed they were. The people in the subway were like, I got to go somewhere. And some of them might even been like, this man's amazing. But they're not in the right mindset.
But then they would have stopped. They should at least stop for a minute. I mean, it happened yesterday. I walked by and I was late to a movie and I saw there was this guy and I was like, man, sounds good. Like,
you're an artist. You're a musician.
So I'm always listening. Yeah, my ears are always.
We tap into that.
Yes.
Regular people, they don't. At least not as much. And the thing of that is, too, is the more open you are on a vibrational level. Like I call my fans the Vibration Nation, not just because I'm trying to be cheesy, but I believe that we operate on these vibrations, man. And the more tapped in you are to that stuff, you know, it sounds hippy dippy, but it's true. And that there's something about like playing bar venues and playing musical venues, right? Now, bar venues will pay you more. Unless you're selling a bunch of tickets or whatever.
Yes.
In general, they're going to pay you more. But the fans that you make, you know, when I was in my old band and even with this band, like we've made some good fans at some bar venues. For sure. We're doing our album celebration show at essentially a bar venue. And that's okay. That's fine. There's going to be people there. They're going to go. They're going to love it. Shout out, shameless plug. June 14th, come out to Perks in Huntington Beach. We're going to be celebrating our album. However, when you play at a venue, right, people are there, they connect with you more. They listen more. The message of your music hits a little more. And that's when people will really buy merch, when people really follow you. And especially if it's a good bill, if you get the right other bands on there, that can become a whole movement in that type of night. So I think that setting is much like psychedelics. Set and setting is extremely important. Now, festivals, that's a whole different element because I think festivals are the better barometer for an artist's ability to perform in some level. Because one, everybody's already a little bit more lenient and they're like, okay, we're here to see if music can have a good time. But there's a lot of it happening everywhere, but they're still in for that. So if you can corral people and draw them and hold them, I think that's a little bit more. If people are walking away from your stage, that might be a thing. Or it's not the festival for you.
Well, you're also seeing several acts on the same stage. So there is the greatest barometer is just that. You're seeing back-to-back acts on the same stage or several stages, and it's going to either hit or it's not. And it's like, for me, I think one of the best things that we have done is road tested songs. like putting the time playing new songs on the road. So I know what songs are going to be on the records and I know where it's going to be on a set list and I know how it's going to hit and what's going to hit. So it's like, it's constantly, you're corralling these audiences, but really I already know when I walk on a stage, what I want the response to be. So that's how I make my set list. You know what I mean? It's like, we have convinced the road, you know, like as we've traveled and toured, so we know what we're going to do. And that's my favorite audience, is the people that have never seen us before, because it's like, we're about to punch you in the mouth. Like on some level, we're going to do something to get your attention.
Oh yeah.
In a good way. Yeah. But I want to play something of yours first. What do you want to play us first?
Let's start with the newest single, cause it's out now and everybody can go check it. If they only catch it here, if they want to hear it again. And that's Life on the Run. That one we just released. It's been out, I think, almost 2 weeks now. It's doing really good. It's rising up. Got it on a couple radio plays. Playing it on here. So, yeah, check it out. Life on the Run.
Here's Life on the Run by Jarnell Cole.
Talk is cheap, but it has a price. Put your hands up, keep your head down. Taking what I want, then I'm skipping town. I sure do love it, baby. I sure do love it.
Hit him in the mouth, right? Whether you need it, dude.
That's how we do it. That's how we do it, man.
Very cool. I heard a little, you had a little fuzz pedal on some of those. Did you have it on the opening riff too?
No. So for that one, I'm running it. That one's pretty much straight into my Orange. Shout out Orange Amps. But I do have it like dying. I have everything like on 10 and just so it gets that fuzz sound. Because all fuzz does, for those who don't know, I know you know, but for those listeners out there who are getting new into guitar and you're wondering, what does a fuzz pedal do? It takes an amp and it turns it to 11 and it puts it in a box. So you can go from 11 to like 8. And that's kind of what they do. Yeah.
What's really cool is like I've been doing this YouTube series and I've been playing with all these old school blues artists.
And I saw.
None of them use pedals, man. I show up with a pedal board and they're like, what are all these things? Well, you don't need all these. And I was like, I know, you're old school. Of course, you're going to plug into the amp. You're going to have this huge guitar sound. But I like colors. Like, I like toys. I like things.
Ain't nothing wrong with some seasoning, you know? Salt and pepper's cool, but like cayenne, my guy. Curry.
Yes.
Garlic.
But I love your guitar tone. It's awesome. And the groove is amazing. The song, the vocals, everything. Tell me a little bit, what was behind the inspiration of the song?
So this whole album is a concept album. Okay. I've been looking to talk about this for a minute, so this is cool. I get to do this on the show. So the album itself is actually a concept album, and it has to do, I was inspired. I don't know what it is with the ether about all us black folk getting together and doing Western stuff. Like Beyonce went country and all this Shaboozy's doing stuff. But I was like, I want to write a concept album that's kind of Western themed. And so from the first to the last, what you have is you have this tale of this protagonist who is in this gang, and they're, you know, just going to the top and living fast and hard, and you know, they're living their life on the run. And then, you know, they get into this kind of thing where there's a betrayal a bit, and the protagonist kind of does some soul searching, and then kind of goes on this vision quest with this this mystic mountain woman. And kind of ends up falling in love and then, you know, trying to change the ways and stuff. But the bandits come back and there's this whole, you know, there's a conflict and it resolves. And, you know, there's an epilogue of angels and all kinds of choirs. That's cool. Yeah. So and that's the thing. Yeah. I wanted it to be a real album that people can just start and just listen to.
What's cool is, you know, that genre that you're kind of writing in is kind of outlaw country, which I love that as like a coin. You're bringing the blues and the rock into it, which is like way more the stuff I love too. It's like, it's got that renegade outlaw country thing, but then you got that blues and rock thing, that Hendrix vibe, and also that old soul thing, you know? So I love that you're kind of mixing all that together. And I love that you brought up that, you know, African-Americans are doing country, because it's like, you know, there should be no genre that anybody can't delve into.
And people aren't ready to understand how much music we invented.
Yes. It's where, and yes.
It is what it is.
Africa is where all music was invented. And it's like, it should always come back, of course. Yes. So it's funny to see all these like responses to Beyonce. That was like the smartest thing she could have ever done.
Facts.
Like,
and that's the thing, is it's been so organic. You know, I was talking to my bro Tito from Buddha Jones and the Man. Shout out Buddha Jones and the Man. And he was saying, you know, that as artists, you know, we have to have our finger on the pulse of just whatever vibe is going on in the world.
Right.
And I truly do believe that, because I think there's a difference between musicians and artists. Because musicians care about the music, artists care about the art, and the artists see here, musicians see here, and it doesn't mean that you can't be both, right? There's a lot of people who are both, but usually people lean one way or another, and that's okay. And sometimes even for different things, you know. I know as a songwriter, I lean much more to the artist spectrum, because I'm looking at here. I'm looking at, you know, not just who I am, but what am I saying? What am I doing with this? What is my purpose?
You started thinking like, what do I want to leave behind?
Yeah, you know, because I think we live a blessed life as musicians, and a lot of people don't think so because of our bank accounts, but that's okay. You know, unless you're Taylor Swift. I think that, you know, as musicians, we have this gift where people listen to what we say. We have a voice. And I think it's very important what we say with it. And I think that we have to say truth, and we have to reflect things of the time. And, you know, the West was wild. And, you know, there was a lot of different feelings of uncertainty, a lot of feelings of being out in these badlands and trying to find your own path in it. And I think a lot of that is where people are today. And I think that's where I was so inspired to write that way.
That's cool.
Wanted to do a concept album, and I wish this one would have been a little more narrative and a little less thematic, because it's a little bit more thematic than narrative per se. But
you have plenty more records to.
That's what I'm saying. You know, there's always another one. Although the next one might be a little funky. Might get a little more funky.
That's funny because one of the reasons I started a blues trio, it's like I just want to write blues all the time. but I didn't want to just my band that's been touring for 20 years. We do like Western African stuff. We do funk. We do reggae. But they all know the next record's just going to be a one big giant funk album. That's all I want it to be. I've never just done. We've done like, you know, sprinkles of funk songs here and there. But I'm like, I just want to funk everybody up for a whole record and then do something completely different for the one after that. But it's like, I love that you said that because, man, we are like parallel souls in a lot of ways. I want to ask you a question. What was the moment of Zen? And I ask everybody that's on the show this. What was the moment of Zen that made you want to be a musician? Was it you growing up with musicians? Was it like a song you heard? What was the moment of Zen that made you think, I want to do this?
So growing up with music, my mom played drums, which is why I got drumsticks tattooed.
Your mom is awesome already, dude.
My dad played guitar, so I got the treble clef, you know, so that way I can just listen to the music. But I gotta say, though I was always around music, I didn't know, like that integral, guttural no. Until I'd say I was probably closer to 16, because at 10 I started playing bass, you know. But like high school, for most of high school, I was a rapper. I did the whole rap thing. Yeah, I just went down that route, and it was fun. It was cool. Had a rap beef. It was great.
You were a SoundCloud rapper.
Oh yeah, I was a SoundCloud rapper. That's why I can talk about him, because I was one. You know, that's the culture. But I remember I was playing guitar. I always kept that going, and. I remember I was busking for this, not for this lady, but this lady was there and she was listening and she's crying, just bawling. And she just tips me $100. And I was like, wow, this is weird. And she's like, no, she's like, you sing beautiful. She goes, that song you played is my husband's and mine song. And I was like, oh, well, like, yeah, it was I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles. She goes, he died like a couple days ago or however long ago it was. I was like, okay. That's not heavy. And she goes, you have a gift. She goes, I needed to know that he was still there or just thinking of me. And then here you are playing our song. Like, don't stop. Like, I needed this. Bro, and here's the thing. That's not even the only time something like that has happened. But that moment specifically, because I was in EMT school when that happened. And I remember being like, music heals wounds too. Like it does a healing that medicine can't. And the more those instances started to happen, the more I was like, this is what I got to do. And I knew that I could do it. I knew that I think it, to answer your question, to know as far as when I wanted to, that was the moment when I knew I wanted to do it. The moment that gave me confidence when I was like, no, I'm meant for this and I can do this was 2016. It was our first US tour and we had gone to New Orleans and we were, Ohio. We'd been to New Orleans for like 2 weeks, but my sister lived out there, so we were kind of couch surfing. But then we went up to Ohio, and it's the furthest we'd been from home, and we were in my little 94 van, Econoline, sleeping in it, eating Chef Boyardee out the can. But I remember waking up and just seeing the trees of this beautiful Walmart parking lot. But having just played a gig and getting paid, and we had enough money that we could keep going and eat and like whatever, and I was like, we're doing it. Like, it's not glamorous, but we are doing it. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, this is it. This is.
And you know what? I think it's like what a lot of musicians, you know, we take for granted that, and I'm going to include myself especially because it's hard to remind yourself, like, that's living. Like,
oh, yeah. Those are the best times.
It's not the security when things are always great. It's when you don't know and you still make it through. It's like there's something about that that is you're living on the edge, and that's living. You know what I mean? So I feel like that's like a huge thing that musicians always like. We kind of like we're right on the edge of that all the time, and that's what keeps us doing it. It's like we forget that riding that line keeps us like to be great artists. Because the moment I was talking about this with a friend of mine, and he's been Pharrell's guitarist for years. We have a production class that we do together, and he's like, you know, what the funny thing is, like, you know, you see a lot of musicians, you know, they take like faculty positions in institutions. And it's like those get really comfortable real fast because you don't have to know where your next paycheck is. And and it's like the thing that we all or maybe they all forget is like, yo, that doesn't keep you to being a great artist. what keeps you to being a great artist is like not knowing where anything's coming from next. And it's like, that's what keeps you hungry, passionate. It's like, and it's weird. We take that energy for granted, but it is really what keeps us on the edge, you know?
So I won't push back, but what I'll say is I think that there's levels, because I think that that is one of the ways and one of the main areas. I think that that is the way it has to be until you hit a certain point.
Right.
Because
right.
I think once you get to the point where you're maybe, I don't necessarily think you need to be a legacy band to be the next rung, but where, you know, where you are, where you've made it and you're successful, now comes the truth to your artistry, right? Yes. They always say like, well, would you rather make a one hit wonder or, you know, have a billion, and everyone's like, I mean, one hit wonder is great. But I think that the true testament of an artist, it's not necessarily, oh, can they have 50 bit? Like, there's never going to be another Beatles, right? At least, I mean, there might be, there should be. I mean, mathematically, there's got to be at least another band that does it. But can you, for you as an artist, can you top yourself? Yes. Can you find that within you to get up there? You know what I'm saying? Even when it's comfortable.
Especially when it's comfortable. Yeah.
Because I look at artists like, so some of my favorite bands, I have two island bands right now, which is Rival Sons and Tedeschi Trucks, for sure. Hands down. And you look at their breakthrough album and you look at some of their new stuff, and it's just the hit. I can turn it on just from one to whatever many are on the album and just let it play. And it's all good, you know? Even going at My Chemical Romance, and a lot of people don't like that, but it's the truth. Like, they're a great band. You know, super emo, but like, whatever. I'm with it. You know, Led Zeppelin, obviously all the greats. I think Sabbath is one of those bands. I think they had a weird period, obviously, you know, when Dio came in and Ozzy was all strung out, and then, you know, but, you know, they came back, they got it. But yeah, I think that I don't know if living on the edge is necessary, is a necessity for long term, but it definitely is for you to break through. And I think that also, I think there's something about living free. There's a freedom that comes with that. And I think that's the thing that a lot of people don't understand we have, they take for granted. Because as an artist, and me and my wife talk about this, I know I'm blessed because I have purpose, right? You know how many people don't have purpose?
Yes.
And like, I don't understand that. I can't think of a time when I didn't have purpose. I mean, like, I can, I guess, but then I was always trying to find it. And having found it now, it makes everything, it sights you in, and it's easy. So now I already know I have to make this music do better today than it was yesterday. And if I'm doing that, it's a good day. And there's other things that matter. You know, I got to make sure me and my wife are doing well. I got to make sure my health is doing well. I got to make sure these bills are paid, for sure. But this thing is like taking up, you know, that is that much space is the thing. And then, you know, everything else is, you know, it's over here. And it's so
cool. It's like, I was like,
yeah, you know, yeah, you know, this is it. But, and it's crazy because I think that's truly the thing that we're most blessed with, because other people, you know, they're worried about 50 billion different things, but we're just worried about one thing. Yeah. And the part that non-artists don't understand is it doesn't mean that we don't love other things or that they don't matter or like whatever, you know, it's that purpose is deeper than that. It's I need that. Like, I need to breathe.
Yes.
You know, it's different.
Let's play another song. What do you want to play next?
Let's do Smoke and Fire. Cause this one's dropping June 8th.
You're smoking fire. You were about to say something.
I was going to say this song is for anybody who has that person in their life where they're like, I wish a mother would, man. This is the song for you. This is the song for you.
You're Smoking Fire by Darnell Cole.
Oh,
And Darnell, where can people find you online? We're going to play one last song on the way out, but I want to make sure we get enough time to play it. So where can people find you online?
Anywhere and everywhere. If it's on Instagram, look up Darnell Cole Music. If you're on Twitter or the app formerly known as Twitter and it's X, it's going to be Darnell Cole Rocks. If you are on YouTube, it's Darnell Cole Music. Facebook is Darnell Cole and the Vibe or Darnell Cole because I have my own there and the band one, but people follow me more. So, hey, whatever. Yeah, anywhere out there, darnellcole.com. You can go online and find me there and find all that. But if you go to my Instagram, I've got the link tree and nice and easy.
Awesome. And you're playing June 14th?
June 14th, I'm going to be playing at Perks in Huntington Beach. It's our album celebration. We're going to have vinyl. We're going to have CDs. We're going to have t-shirts, stickers, all the whole nine, you name it, we'll have it. So come hang out. Come show some love and vibe with us.
And what's the last song we're playing tonight?
The last one, had to do it right and do Into Vibration, because that's where I want everybody to go, is Into Vibration with us.
Here's Into Vibration. We'll see you guys next week. Darnell Cole taking us out.
Here on LA Talk Radio.